We're continuing here in our study of the book of Ezra, now in chapter 6, and we covered through the first 15 verses of the chapter last week that gave us the account of how the work on the second temple was able to be completed. So it was completed there in verse 15. It says, on the third day of the month, Adar, which was in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king. In order to have that work on the temple completed and completed at that time that it was God's work to fulfill a number of promises that he made and prophecies that he had made. He worked many things together for good to make that happen. That of course, began in this book with at the very beginning of Ezra when he had Cyrus, and God, it says, had stirred up his spirit of Cyrus to send the captives back to make that decree that they could return to Israel, all of them, all of the Israelites, and that he then also commissioned to have the temple rebuilt, and including its financing and everything. So God initiated that, which was also in fulfillment of very specific prophecies that he'd made through Isaiah, where he named Cyrus and that work that he was going to do some 200 years beforehand. Also in the book of Jeremiah, pertaining to the time period of the captivity and of the desolations of Jerusalem. God had said that would be for 70 years. So there were many prophecies that he was going to be bringing to pass through that work concerning the rebuilding of the temple in the city of Jerusalem. So the captives went back and they laid the foundation of the temple. The devil tried his various means to hinder God's work. He finally succeeded through their enemies as they wrote letters to the government of Persia accusing the Jews of planning a rebellion against Persia. Called their attention to the rebellion that they had made against the king of Babylon, which led to the destruction of the temple and to the captivity of the remnant of the children of Israel back in Nebuchadnezzar's time. That did happen, but they were using that to accuse the Jews of planning the same thing against the Persians, which that was a false accusation. The rulers that were now in Persia, this being after Cyrus's time, gave authorization for those neighbors of the Jews to have the work to be stopped, which they then brought those letters to the Israelites, and they succeeded in having the work stopped until it reached the second year of Darius, the king of Persia. And at that point, there were 5 years left on the time period to have the temple completed according to God's prophecies. So the Lord did allow a delay, which fit into his purposes for the time frame to be exactly as he had said it would be. But then he used those prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, to encourage the people to build, told them to get back to the work and build the temple, which they then resumed the building, and which provoked another letter from their enemies that were around them, asking the Persians to search their records because the Jews had said they had authorization to build the temple from Cyrus. Then when we get to chapter 6, that search was made of their records, and Cyrus's decree was found, and so then Darius ordered that the work be completed. Now, all of that was based on what law of the Persians, because we might ask, well, by most nations or kingdoms, if the new king says, don't do this, then that's the end of it. Why would Darius say, okay, this order to stop the work is now to be revoked, and that work has to be finished because some other king a number of years ago said it was to be done? What was special about the Persian legal system that came into play here that made this to be, to go the way it did, to where it was going to be, this work was going to be ordered to be finished? What was unique about the Persians' laws, or what was one law in particular that made them to be distinct from really any other nation or kingdom that we read about? They had a law that says they couldn't change their laws, yes. And that's the reason why Darius said, when the search was made and Cyrus's decree was found, that Darius said, okay, this has to be done. I'm not making that up, by the way. I would hope that I would not do that at any point, but just to make sure that we're clear on that, in the book of Daniel, in chapter 6 and verse 8, of course, this is during the time of the Persian rulers, and this is the chapter about Daniel and the lion's den. And so they, the Daniel's enemies provoked the king to make a 30-day law prohibiting any request being made of any being other than the king for that period of time, which meant that outlawed prayer for 30 days. And they knew that Daniel would pray to God always, and so they were intentionally provoking the king to make this law for that purpose, though the king did not know what their underhanded reasons were. And obviously he should not have made that order and regretted it. And the penalty for disobeying that law was being thrown to the lions, and that's what happened with Daniel. Of course, God stopped the mouths of the lions so that he was not killed per their plans. But they were using that Persian law. They knew if they could get that decree made against they were going to use against Daniel, that it couldn't be changed when the king became aware of what their real intention was. And so in Daniel chapter 6, verse 8, they said, "Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing, that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not." So there's a very specific reference there in Daniel chapter 6 and verse 8 to that law that the Persians had, whereby they could not change their laws. And then they mentioned it again in verse 15. It says, "Then these men assembled unto the king and said unto the king, Know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree nor statute which the king establisheth may be changed." So that was the entire basis of what they were doing against Daniel in that situation. We know it failed, but they still used that law. And there's a very explicit statement about what the Persian law was about all their other laws. You couldn't change them. In the book of Esther, which is another book during the time of the Persian rulers, in the first chapter and verse 19, the king's servants were urging him to make a royal commandment, and said, "If it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes that it be not altered." And that was their intent, to have him to make a decree that was going to end up being against the Queen Vashti, which was going to lead to ultimately Esther becoming the queen. But there's another reference to the laws of the Medes and Persians that could not be altered. So since Cyrus had made that royal decree to have the temple to be built, including the financing of it, then when the search was made for that law, and there again is a reason why the Persians were so careful to keep their records, because who would be able to remember every decree like that, going back to however long it was? It would really be beyond any person's ability to know every decree that had ever been made by the Persian rulers, to remember that, to say, okay, no, back in whatever date that this rule was made, so this new one this new law can't be passed, because that would change that other law. So they had their records and kept them obviously very carefully and meticulously, so that such a mistake should not be made. And so they made a search there as it tells us in verse 1 of chapter 6, Darius the king made a decree, and search was made in the house of the rolls, where the treasures that were laid up in Babylon. So they had a special place where those records were stored, and that's where they went to search, and that's where they found Cyrus's decree from the first year of his reign concerning the temple and the children of Israel to build it, and with the financing to do so. And so when that was discovered, then Darius sent a letter to those, the reply to the Jews' enemies, and told them that this work was to be done. And not only that, he told them that their own taxes from that side of the river were going to be used for the financing the completion of the work. So not only had they failed now in their efforts to stop it, their own money is going to be used to cause this work to be completed by the order of the king. And furthermore, if they tried to hinder that work in any way, then they were going to be killed. Their houses would be pulled down, and then from the rubble they were going to set up gallows and hang them on that, and their house would be made a dunghill. That was in verse 11. So a very stiff penalty indeed was placed there by Darius upon any that was going to hinder this work to be done. And he made this decree and said, let it be done with speed, in verse 12. So then we saw in verse 13 that Tatnai, the governor on that side of the river, and Shethar-Boznai and their companions did speedily cause Darius's decree to be followed. And so then in verse 14 it says, and the elders of the Jews built it, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo, and they built it and finished it according to the commandment of the God of Israel, and according to the commandment of Cyrus and Darius and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. And this house was finished on the third day of the month Adar, which was in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king, which would put that in the year 516 BC, which was exactly 70 years after the destruction of the first temple by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians, which had occurred in 586 BC. So this shows how God used all of this and worked all of this to fulfill that prophecy. But how many different kings and rulers and things did he work through and use and to cause all of this to go exactly according to his plans? And that's something obviously that God alone can do, but He certainly did that there, and then the work was finished, as he said. Now, it mentions the month there in verse 15 here in Ezra chapter 6, the month Adar. Which month is that in the Jewish calendar? Well, if we can flip back to the book of Esther for a moment, to chapter 3, we can find the answer to that and also see the name of the following month. But Esther chapter 3, verse 7 says, "In the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot, before Haman from day to day and from month to month to the 12th month, that is the month Adar." So there we have named two of the months of the Jewish calendar. So the month Adar is which month? The 12th month. So that would be the month that the temple was completed there in Daniel chapter 6 and verse 15. So on the third day of that 12th month. So what month follows that? The month Nisan, which is the first month. Now, what was special about that month, the first month? Somebody might say, well, because that's the first month of the year, New Year. Well, yes, that obviously is something very special about that. But how did the Jewish calendar, who established it and when and under what circumstances? Did the Jews come up with their months and naming which one was the first one, and did they just design that on their own? Is that something that was just came to be somewhere in the distant past that at this point would be untraceable to know the origins of it? That's right. God did that at the time of the Exodus. So he back in Exodus chapter 12, when God was about to bring the 10th and final plague upon the Egyptians with the killing of the firstborn, in Exodus 12, verse 1, it says, "And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, This month shall be unto you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you." Because this is the month where they were going to have their beginning as an independent nation. I mean, they had been a nation as far as their number. They had multiplied. God had fulfilled a promise, one of the promises he'd made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that he would multiply their seed and make their number to be like the sand on the seashore and the stars in the sky for its multitude. Well, he had done that. They had their separate region that they dwelt in as a separate people in the land of Goshen in Egypt. But they had multiplied to such an extent, as God fulfilled that promise, that the Egyptians then were became worried that these people would become so strong that they would be at risk of being conquered by them. So then what did they end up doing with the Jews to try to keep that from happening? Well, they subjugated them and turned them into their slaves and became very difficult taskmasters to them. And so they had a very harsh servitude that they were brought into. And that's the background of how the book of Exodus begins. And so then God took this nation that he had multiplied, but as they were slaves of the Egyptians in their land, I mean, obviously Israel was not its own independent nation at that point. They had a territory that God was going to grant to them, but first he was going to release them from their bondage to where they were going to be a free people. And they were going to be an independent nation. And that began that month with the exodus from Egypt. And so that was the reason that God chose that time as he was giving birth to them as a nation. That was going to be the beginning of their months. And so what great event occurred at that time in their first month that led to the Exodus? Well, that 10th plague in which the angel of the Lord that brought destruction on all the firstborn in Egypt passed over the houses of the Hebrews that had killed the Passover lamb and put the blood on their doorposts above the door, the doors of their houses. And so God's angel passed over their dwelling places and they were spared from the plague. What feast did they keep from that point onward that commemorated that event? That was the Feast of the Passover, and followed by the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So they had the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread at the beginning of the year every year. Well, at least they were supposed to. They didn't always keep that like God had instructed them to, especially during those times when their hearts were turned away from the Lord and they turned to idols. But they did have the ones that God gave them as righteous rulers that brought them back into observance of the Lord's commandments, including that. And we had a couple of, very notably in the times of Hezekiah and Josiah, they brought back the observance of the Passover. So at the time when this temple, the rebuilding of the temple, is completed in the 12th month, I mean, that tells us that there it is right on the eve of what's to come next, and that's the first month, and then the observance of the Passover. So there is a lot happening in this time for the captives that had returned to the land and now completed the temple, and on the on that third day of the 12th month in the sixth year of the reign of Darius. So that was done. The next thing is they're going to be dedicating this temple to be completed. After the dedication of the temple, the people are then, we get to the next month, and they're going to observe the Passover. So in Ezra chapter 6 verse 17, as we continue our study of this chapter, verse 16 says, "And the children of Israel, the priests and the Levites and the rest of the children of the captivity, kept the dedication of this house of God with joy, and offered at the dedication of this house of God 100 bullocks, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and for a sin offering for all Israel, 12 he-goats, according to the number of the tribes of Israel. And they set the priests in their divisions and the Levites in their courses for the service of God, which is at Jerusalem, as it is written in the book of Moses." So verses 16 through 18 tells us about this temple was dedicated. We don't have quite the same level of detail that's given here as when the first temple, the original one, was dedicated by Solomon when it was completed, where we have two very long chapters, 1 Kings chapter 8 and then 2 Chronicles chapter 6, that contains the details of the dedication of the original temple and the words that Solomon had spoken. But with this temple, the second temple that is built, it also had a dedication, and the people celebrated this occasion with joy at its dedication, as we can very well understand why they should have done that. So they were very joyous over the completion of the temple. Now that particular building, even though we're not going to read about it in the scriptures, as far as what would happen later during the years between its completion and its dedication here, we really don't read anything more about that building itself, its appearance or anything like that. The next time we really read about that was in the New Testament in the time of Christ. And in particularly, we read about its appearance in Matthew 24, also Mark 13, Luke 21. Those chapters contain the account of when, as Jesus was beginning his last week on the earth, they showed him the temple and they pointed out its great stones and at that time was it an impressive looking building? Obviously so. That's what they were pointing out to Jesus. And what was Jesus' response at that time? When they were showing him the great stones of that temple, he said not one was going to be left upon another. That temple itself was going to be destroyed soon. In fact, that happened in the year 70 AD by the Romans. So here's the beginning of that building. God did bring a great glory to it with the works that Jesus did at that temple and his teachings there. But he did end up bringing destruction to that building eventually at the hands of the Romans in 70 AD. Point being that though we don't read anything more about this temple from when it was finished until the time of Christ, a lot of work was done. And particularly one of the projects by Herod, who was referred to as Herod the Great, and this would be in the period that's referred to as between the Testaments. We don't have the book of Malachi ends where somewhere 300 and something years before Christ. So there we have a 300 and something period between that and what we read about with the John the Baptist being born and then Christ. So somewhere approximately 400 years where we don't have any inspired books that contain information about what was going on in that period of time. There are historical records, though, that contain records of events that occurred. And there was a very extensive renovation carried out by Herod the Great on the temple. So it was expanded, and those great stones that we read about in Matthew 24 and Mark 13, Luke 21, those were added by Herod. So he did a lot to enhance that building that was originally completed here in the book of Ezra. So it was expanded, renovated, and there are remnants of those, at least of the foundation. There's the what is that? The Western Wall, Jan, that goes way back. That's there. You've seen that, I think. And we probably all know about it, the Wailing Wall, and even today the Orthodox Jews put little slips of paper in the cracks or the crevices of that wall so that they have their little prayers they write down there, and that is a place where they make their lamentations and things. But anyway, so there is still a remnant of the foundation of that structure there, but nothing of the building itself remains. But just to keep in mind, there was a lot of work done, a major renovation project that was carried out by Herod the Great that added to this building. But that's really all we read about the physical structure. So we know it was a much more impressive-looking building in Christ's time than it was at the time it was finished here in the book of Ezra. But it contained everything that it needed here from the outset, and that is demonstrated by what we're told there in verses 17 and 18, what happened when they dedicated it. What did they end up doing at that time? Well, they made the sacrifices, and then they set the priests in their divisions and the Levites in their courses for the service of God, which is at Jerusalem, as it is written in the book of Moses, it says. So up until this point, as we had noted from going back to chapter 3, when they laid the foundation, even before they laid the foundation, what was the first thing that they did before they even laid the foundation of this building? They set up what? The altar there? Because they could start making sacrifices, the daily sacrifices and things. So they had started, and they observed the Feast of Tabernacles at that time. So they, from the time they got back to the land of Israel, they started with their observance of the Lord's commandments as they were able to do so. I mean, they were not able to do that when they were in Babylon. I mean, were they able to observe the Passover or the Feast of Weeks or the Feast of Tabernacles, the Day of Atonement, any of those events? Could they do any of that when they were in Babylon? And what was the reason they couldn't? The answer is no, they couldn't. And why not? Well, the Lord had commanded that that be done in the place where he chose for where the tabernacle and then later the temple, because it started in Shiloh with the tabernacle, and that's where that remained through the period of the judges all the way until when Samuel was a youngster. But then when the temple was built and completed by Solomon, it was in Jerusalem. So those were the only two locations, one for the tabernacle, that is Shiloh, and then Jerusalem for the temple. But those were the only two places in Israel's history, and they were not at the same time, as we know, but those were the places that the Lord chose for where those structures would be located that contained the holy place and the most holy place, and that's where God told them to come for the observance of those three feasts during the year. And they had other things that were to be done there in that building, including the Day of Atonement, and many other things. So they had the daily works that would occur there. That couldn't be done without there being a temple. So they couldn't they didn't have a place to gather. There was no temple that existed when they were in Babylon. So they couldn't observe many of those commandments that the Lord gave them while they were over there. So now that they've returned, they immediately start keeping commandments that they can. But there were, how many commandments were tied to or contingent upon this temple being completed? Well, a lot. And all these different works that the priests and Levites did, they had to have the temple finished before they could do all of it. But now that it's finished, what do? Other than dedicating it and celebrating it, what do they do at the same time? They have everything organized for the priests and Levites now to all fulfill their service as it is written in the book of Moses. So how many commands now are they not able to obey that was in the law of Moses? Now that the temple's completed, they can do all of it. Was that a reason for them to have joy? Was the joy, was it tied to just that they've got this physical building now? Or was it because of what that building meant in terms of fulfilling the will of God? Well, that's what it was for. Now they're able to do that. And so we can see that is clearly in their understanding and the source of their joy there. I mean, it would be for us, I mean, if we were, for whatever reason, unable to be able to assemble together on the first day of the week, and I know we've all experienced that for one reason or another. Many times it will be because of health reasons or something else that we can't be here or something. But when we're not able to do that, I mean, how does it make us as Christians? How do we feel about that? And I think all of us, that's a source of grief to us when we can't do that. So if there's anything that hinders us from being able to do something that the Lord desires us to do, and we can understand what it, the joy that is, that we have when we know that there's no hindrance to anything and we can do all the things that God commands us to do. And that's one of the reasons why we do need to pray for one another and our health, and so that physically we're not in any way unable to do any of the things that God would have us to. But there were some hindrances to the obedience of many of God's commandments as long as they did not have a temple, just like we saw for after the tabernacle was Shiloh was destroyed until the temple was completed by Solomon. And that was a reason that was first and foremost in David's mind. And when he became king, that's why the first act that he took was to drive the Jebusites out of Jerusalem, call it the city of David, and then seek God's authorization, move the Ark of the Covenant there to the city, and then have God's authorization to build a temple there, so that all of those things that were not able to be done for all those years where there was no tabernacle, now that could be, that problem, spiritual problem for Israel could be fixed. And it was at the time when the temple was finished. So we're seeing the same thing again now that goes back to David and Solomon. And the joy that occurred for Israel when they were able to resume their obedience to every commandment that God had. Now the same situation here. Verses 19 through 22, he says, "And the children of the captivity kept the Passover upon the 14th day of the first month." And we can easily see why that is mentioned immediately in following the completion of the temple and its dedication and setting in order all of those services of the priests and Levites after the temple was completed. The next thing that's mentioned is the observance of the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. Reason why? Well, that's the next month. I mean, the temple was completed in their 12th month. The next month here now is their first month, and that's the month for the observance of the Passover. During this time, if one happened to be one of these people, they'd been in captivity for all those years in Babylon, they come back to Israel, and now at this time, the temple's completed in 1 month, and now they can observe the Passover the next month. So there's a lot of occasion for rejoicing by the people of Israel at this particular time. So this is certainly one of the high points after the captivity has been returned. So they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. Verse 20 says, "For the priests and the Levites were purified together, all of them were pure, and killed the Passover for all the children of the captivity, and for their brethren, the priests, and for themselves. And the children of Israel, which were come again out of captivity, and all such as had separated themselves unto them from the filthiness of the heathen of the land, to seek the Lord God of all, Lord God of Israel, did eat, and kept the feast of unleavened bread 7 days with joy. For the Lord had made them joyful and turned the heart of the king of Assyria unto them to strengthen their hands in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel." So we can see who was behind all this. Who was the one that made all this possible for them? It was God. And God was giving them all of these blessings. How could this have happened any other way than through God? Every good and every perfect gift comes from Him. And without His work on their behalf to make this possible, He's the one that made into plains those great mountains that were before them. God was the one that did that. And so He's the one that turned their captivity, returned them to the land, made it possible for them to rebuild the temple, and made it possible for them to do all of these things they were doing now to keep the Lord's commandments. Now, the blessings that they're receiving from Him at this time, is it in any way tied to the heart, the kind of hearts that they had? It is. I mean, these were the good figs, as God described them in Jeremiah 24, that He said He would give them hearts to know Him and to fulfill His will. So He worked in them, and they did turn their hearts to the Lord, and we can see that in the description that He gives at the time when they observed the Passover. They knew that was coming, and they had a little over 1 month from the time the temple was completed on the third day of the 12th month unto the Passover, which was the 14th day of the following month. So they had a little over a month to prepare for it, and they used that time wisely and righteously. So the priests and Levites purified themselves together to prepare for that. And then they killed the Passover for all the children of the captivity. Their purification and having the, that would be a lot of, there would be a lot of Passover lambs that would have to be sacrificed for the observance of that Passover feast. All that had to be prepared for this to be done for the entire nation. So there was a lot, I mean, that it mentions there what they did in verse 20, but if we really consider what went into that, what he's describing in verse 20, that was not just a small thing there, was it? I mean, that was a lot that went into that, all of that preparation, so that that could be done in accordance with God's will. But they did all of that. And then verse 21 tells us what the people did. They didn't just observe the Passover, but what does it say about them? They had separated themselves from the filthiness of the heathen of the land to seek the Lord God of Israel. That's what the people had done. What does that tell us about their hearts? And that is certainly tied to God's blessings that He provided for them. So this is what we're reading here at the close of Ezra chapter 6 is a lot of good that is there. And particularly with the hearts of the people and how God blessed them for that. Separating themselves from the filthiness of the heathen of the land. Now, how many times did the people of Israel not do that in their history? Now, is that something physical or spiritual that he's describing there? Well, there are going to be some physical actions that will be a manifestation of it, but this is a spiritual thing that he's describing to have themselves separated from the filthiness of the heathen of the land. Here they are separating themselves for God's purpose to come out from among these people of the world and to be separate for God and not to touch the unclean thing. This is what God had commanded them in the Old Testament, and that's what's quoted and applied to us in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and in verses 14 through 19 in that chapter, where we're told to come out from from among them, from this world, to be separate for God, because there's no fellowship between righteousness and unrighteousness. And so in verses 17 and 18 of 2 Corinthians 6, he says, "Wherefore come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean things, and I will receive you, and I will be a father unto you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty." So he's quoting from the Old Testament there and applying it to us. And, of course, then the very next verse in chapter 7, verse 1, he says, "Having therefore these promises, dearly beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God." How far are we to take that, separating ourselves from the wickedness of this world and to be holy to God? Well, we are to perfect that holiness in the fear of God. We need to be completely holy, not just a little bit or a lot, mostly, but completely. That's what that word perfect, perfecting means, as we know. It means to complete that. So we are to be fully separated from God and not to be partakers of the wickedness of this world in any way. We're not to touch any of the filthiness or uncleanliness of this world. What's behind that? That fear of the Lord, which is to hate evil and to love righteousness, to seek to see that good and then do it. That's what the people were doing here. And so this is a very good example. So as we're looking for good examples from the Old Testament to encourage us in that, this is a very good one for us to keep in mind. And as part of that, God is the one that blessed them for this, so they could do all of these things. And the Lord had made them joyful. Well, he's the one that gives us all the reasons to be joyful. So these were all blessings from God. And what did he have to do to make that happen? Well, he turned the heart of the king of Assyria. And, of course, the Persian rulers ruled over all that had once been the Assyrian and Babylonian empires. And there's reference made to those areas they ruled over. But how many kings did God turn the hearts of to make all of these blessings and provide all of this for his people? It reminds us, and this will close here, in Proverbs chapter 21 and verse 1, this isn't the only time that that God did this. Proverbs chapter 21 and verse 1, he makes a general statement about God's work. And says, "The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord as the rivers of water. He turneth it whithersoever he will." What about the rulers of the nations today? And how does this impact us? As we read about God, was he doing a miracle to turn the hearts of those kings to stir them up to do these things? To make these laws, these decrees, that were going to bring these blessings to his children that were seeking him with all of their heart? Were those miraculous works as he used the rulers in that time to make those blessings, provide that for his people? We're not reading about miraculous works there. When you look at the decrees they make, what is visible, physically visible from that, that would say, "Oh yes, that look there, you can see God doing that action of turning their hearts to make that happen." That's something we can see only by faith. But God says he's the one doing that, and we can see an example of it there. When we ask God to provide for us rulers, authorities, and laws that will enable us to live quiet and peaceable lives in all godliness and honesty, as he instructs us to pray for in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. When we do that, do we have any reason to believe the words that we're making and the requests that we're making of God in that? Well, we better, We better believe from what we're asking for. He tells us to do that, but what does that example show us in all that we've seen in this first half of the book of Ezra? All these many ways in which God does that work, and he's still doing that today, still able to do that today. And so do we need to ask the Lord to turn the hearts of the rulers of the nations of this land for the sake of his children? And do we need to perfect holiness and the fear of God to gain his favor, to grant us more of those blessings so that we can do his service and not be hindered in that? Those are all good things for us to pray for as we have this example here. And we'll close now going to our Heavenly Father in prayer.